Okay, if there are no questions, let me proceed to this rather cryptically titled topic, What You Owe Them Out There. It kind of reminded me of the way that somebody wanted to know how to end a sentence with five prepositions, and the little boy had the answer when he was sick up in an upstairs bedroom, and he said to his mother one day, "Why did you bring that book I didn't want you to read to me from out of up for?" But what you owe them out there is really a look at some ethical questions that have to do with our ministry. And I'm not talking here about what we owe them in terms of the preaching of the gospel, what we owe them as far as being faithful as in our pastorate and visiting our members and counseling and encouraging them, or the exercise of discipline about which we spoke last time or whatever, but rather more ethical types of things that deal with how do we deal with people, what do we owe the members of our congregation, what do we owe our brother pastors and our sister congregations, what do we owe those who have been placed over us in a kind of supervisory way in the district and in the synod. If there is any biblical reference or base, I'm thinking, for example, of what St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9. We usually quote those other words, "I've become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some." But before that, Paul says that he does not want to abuse his power in the gospel. That he does not want to abuse his power in the gospel. And we have a real power in that gospel ministry, a power because the gospel itself is power, and power also rightly understood in the authority that God gives to us in the pastoral office. But Paul goes on to say that he has made himself the servant of all, and elsewhere talks about enduring everything for the elect's sake, for the sake of the people. And I've listed some at random types of things that I'll mention, first of all, as far as what we owe the congregation. Number one, we owe them more than 9 months' service. By January of 1984, there are going to be a lot of district presidents who will be receiving letters that will begin something like this: "I am a 1983 graduate of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, and even though I've only served here for 7 months, I would like you to consider me for a call into your district because I feel that my work here is pretty well come to an end." And then they go on to describe the intransigence of their congregation, that they have no hopes of ever being able to accomplish anything there. "And besides, my wife's relatives live in your district," and the like, and they would like to get out. Some people seem to have a kind of taken as their motto on their first call what Paul said to Barnabas at the end of Acts 15, that we should go and visit the brethren in every city. Now, I think this may enter in a little bit with, don't want to be facetious, but our view of the call is very easy for us going through theological interview and a final year interview and being so intimately known and knowing so intimately our professors and others that under God are responsible for our first assignment, that we may be tempted to think that this is kind of some capricious little placement that a bunch of people have done. And once we get out there, then comes the real divinity of the call when another congregation calls us, and that this is really a completely human thing that has simply been set up to exercise authority over us as we leave. I hope and pray that you don't feel that way. There is a very strong human element in our placement, and there's a very strong human element also in succeeding calls that we will receive. I guess I've sat in 200 to 250 call meetings, and I've been at every kind of call meeting that you can imagine, from the large metropolitan, very slickly operated call committee procedure with all of the niceties and all of the things that have been done properly and in order, to those little call meetings way out in what we call the boonies, where there are 7, 9, 12 people sitting in a very small room and leaning almost completely upon the counsel of the district president, bewildered because they have a little paragraph describing the various candidates that have been proposed for the office. And yet when we review what has been done by our church, and how we see how marvelously God works through these very humble ways of calling people, and that with all the human element involved, behind this is truly the divine call from our God himself that moves us from one place to the other. And if that is true in those areas where we are, you know, unknown primarily to the people who will extend future calls to us, it is certainly true also with the first call that you are to receive here. And I am not saying thereby that we have to stay 5, 8, and 9 years in a congregation that may have little opportunity for growth or expansion, or that as we mature we may be ready for things that to us seem much more exciting. God knows that if it were not for those small congregations of the Synod, and were we to take all of those away, all of the places that you're going to be put into, there would be very little left of the Missouri Synod. They are important in terms of the nurture of the people of God who are there. And you'll find among them, in most instances, a marvelous spirit of commitment to the cause of Christ and a very deep love to the Synod. But my plea is only that we do not bombard the officials and the powers that be a few months after we are in office seeking something that is more to, quote, our liking. I know that there are exceptions where there are problems, where there are health problems, where there are other things that enter into the situation. But it is very discouraging to the people as well. I spoke when I lectured and gave the essay at the South Dakota District Convention. I may have said this at a previous forum with a lay person who said, I've been a member of this congregation for about 40 years. We've never had anybody but a candidate, and we love these young men, but we never really get to know them. Most of them don't even stay 2 years. They leave before we can really get to love them and to know them. And we know that there are those kinds of places in the Synod where there tends to be much more rapid turnover than in others, but do indeed look upon the call as one that, while programmed by very human and fallible people, is yet a call from God. Secondly, you owe your congregation some courtesy in the presentation of future calls. Can you imagine how a congregation feels when the pastor announces, I have declined a call extended to me from such and such congregation, but has never bothered to present that call to them for their counsel? And in some instances, does not ever inform them that he got the call. Now this, dear brothers in Christ, is simply not proper and ethical procedure. If another congregation extends a call to us, then certainly we have the obligation to share this with the people to whom we have been called, so that they can counsel with us and help us reach a God-pleasing decision. It's not a popularity contest, and I know that often it comes out that way when we have a voters' assembly and people kind of say, well, sure, we like our pastor, we don't want him to go. And the vote, is looked upon as whoever likes the pastor votes he stays, and whoever doesn't like the pastor votes that he goes. But we ought to show our congregation the courtesy of sharing this with them. Now, there may be some exceptions in terms of calling a big meeting to discuss every call. We have some pastors who get 12 and 14 and 15 calls a year. And if you've just turned down a call to a congregation of 1,500 communicants, and you've had the whole congregation out, and you've discussed where you're at in your ministry, and what are the challenges here, and what are the challenges at the other place, and you've all agreed, and this is the fourth time this quarter that you've discussed something like this with your congregation, and then the following week you get a call to a congregation that obviously does not have a tenth of the challenge of the one you just turned down. I'm not saying that you have to then corral everybody to come to another meeting. You may want simply to share with the elders and the officers and ask their opinion as to whether or not it's necessary to call still another meeting. But those are more the exceptions. It is our right, and it is their right and our duty to present to them prayerfully and to ask for their help when we do receive calls to a different place. Thirdly, we owe our congregations proper restraint in chasing rumors. When you get out into the ministry, you are going to have all kinds of people approach you, or there are all kinds of winds of rumors about what is happening, that this person may be guilty of this particular sin, that this one is engaging in a behavior that is not proper. I used to get regular anonymous clippings as a district president advising me of here was a unionistic service, and most frequently it was simply a case of almost every instance of bad reporting or misunderstanding or whatever. Just the other day, unfortunately, I got another one of these letters talking about no members of the faculty in particular and no specific charges, but just one of these things that there are some among you, you know, who are guilty of only God knows what the charge is, but as a result of this kind of thing, I am supposed to do something. And I used to tell my pastors, I am not going to spend my time chasing down rumors. I have enough real problems to worry about without chasing down things that may or may not be true. When you ask people about some of these things in a parish and say to them, have you talked to this person about this? No. Well, see, they want you then to go out and to be the boogeyman and to take on this particular problem, which you're not even sure is true. So be very careful and show the right kind of restraint in chasing down all kinds of rumors that will be brought to you by people in the community or even by your own members. And hand in hand with that, you owe your congregation proper action on specific accusations to make sure that Matthew 18 is truly followed. I'll give you one rather gross example of an instance in which a Christian day school teacher had been accused of some conduct unbecoming a Christian. And when the pastor, who was a man of considerable years of experience and not a rookie by any means, immediately called the Board of Education to a special meeting and told the teacher that he was calling a meeting to consider some charges brought against him, when the teacher did not even know what the charge was, who had brought against him. Now, can you imagine what this did to the ministry of the young man? As it turned out, the charges were not true, but what it did nonetheless to the ministry of this teacher in this congregation because of the way in which this was handled. So let us be very careful that the accused have their day and that they have the right to be faced. Are you willing to confront this person with this accusation if it is in a semi-public thing, let us say? I think you know what I'm saying. This may not be put into the realm necessarily of ethical questions, but I'm going to mention it anyway because there's been so much talk about ties today and programs and taking them on. By the way, I think they look very, very nice. I'm not suggesting that you ought to wear ties. I don't recall that I did after I got out of prep school, where we had military training and we had to wear them every day in khaki shirts. But you owe your people proper dress and appearance, and I'm suggesting that this is a pretty good place to train, because if you are not careful in your appearance here, it's very difficult to turn that off and to turn on all of a sudden someone who gives the proper appearance. And I must frankly say to you that this is one thing that is quite disturbing to the people of the church, and something that is mentioned quite frequently, and that is the dress and the appearance of their pastor. It's always disconcerting when I go to a meeting of a congregation and the worst dressed person in the whole assembly is a pastor of the congregation. And the people say, you know, this fella comes, he's got on a clergy shirt with a dirty friar tuck at the top, baggy pants, tennies, and he's going in to make his hospital calls. Now, as I say, I don't think you have to be dressed in your Sunday finery here, but you ought to have your beard trimmed and your face clean and your hair combed, and you ought not smell like Peterson Fieldhouse as you walk around the campus, because if you don't set those kind of habits, I think it's going to be very difficult for you to have the respect, and the people love their pastors and they want to love you, and you make it pretty difficult if you don't give to them the kind of appearance that befits the office of the ministry. And I guess I'm saying a good time to begin is right now. And in general, an evangelical approach. You know, if there's a danger today that there's a lack of respect for the ministry, there is also, and that's very, very real danger, through no fault of our own. There is also the danger that we help to destroy that respect by not dealing evangelically. These things seem so obvious, but isn't it terrible when a pastor has a specific situation in the congregation, he's had a problem with a certain family or whatever, and now he uses the pulpit to defend himself or to make even accusations? Never, never use the pulpit for the airing of your own particular problems or the problems of other people. I say that seems so self-evident, but because it still happens on occasion, we need to say it again. And to remember that some things need to be ignored. There are a lot of things in the ministry that you cannot ignore. To ignore them is to be derelict in your duty. But there are a lot of little insults and remarks and snide things that go on, petty little things that go on, and maybe go on in the campus that we simply do best to ignore. Somebody has said, if you make a mountain out of a molehill, don't expect everybody to come up and admire the view. And so some things also in the ministry are best simply said, okay, that's the way it is. And as long as I know my heart by God's grace, my conscience is clear, then I will simply ignore this rather petty behavior on the part of others. Now, you owe something to your brothers in the ministry, and you owe something to their congregations. One of them is a rather humble spirit. I guess I've talked about this already, that we, with our brothers in the ministry, don't give the impression that we feel that now that our education is complete, we can instruct them as to how the ministry really ought to be conducted. I find that this complaint on the part of bishops in vicarages are very, very slight today, and I don't think that is so much of a problem. Maybe it was even more so in the days that I came through here, that vicars used to go out and try to help the bishop now straighten out his ministry. But it can still happen that we kind of give the impression and immediately begin to expound and to share all of the vast knowledge that we have at every Winkle conference on every conceivable point of the office of the ministry. Some of these men have learned a few things in the 40 years or whatever that they have been out there. Or to too much offer our services for positions of honor immediately. The story of Abraham Lincoln, who had a kind of a pest, who was always wanting to be promoted, And when one of Lincoln's staff died, this man came immediately again to ask if he could take his place. And Lincoln said, "If it's all right with the undertaker, it's all right with me." Secondly, we owe our brothers in the ministry and our other congregations confrontation when there is conflict. Seems to me that so many of the problems that we have internos, pastor and pastor, pastor and teacher, teacher and teacher, become made so much the worse because we do not have the whatever it takes to confront the problem head on, not in a crass and a tactless way, but by way of face-to-face confrontation. I've had so many pastors in my study and teachers in my study, and they say, you know, I can't get him to do this, he won't do that, he does this, the other thing, we don't seem to get along. They say, have you talked to him about it? No. I say, well, you've told me about it in a pretty nice way, why don't you go and talk to him and say it to him in the same way? And then come back and see me in a month. A month later, they come back and then they say, did you talk to him? No, things are going better now. Things are going better now. It's the same way that you're going to run into when you have husband and wife trouble and you try to get the two of them to confront one another, and then they'll come back and say, no, things are going better now. And they're going better for about 6 weeks until finally the whole thing blows up again. And then you finally have to say to them, now, what would a doctor do if you came and after he had prescribed a couple bottles of pills and you came back the next time, you say, did the pills help? You say, I didn't take them. He would say to you, why do you come to me? You're wasting my time and your money. And so we owe our brothers and sisters who are involved with us in the professional ministry of the word a kind of a good confrontation. Paul did that, you remember, with Peter. He could have gone home and got a real bellyache over the fact that Peter acted as he did, but in Galatians 2, he said, I withstood him to the face. And he had to talk to him about that kind of thing. And so we need to do it too. All problems become smaller if you don't dodge but confront them. Touch a thistle timidly, and it pricks you. Grasp it boldly, and its spines crumble. We owe our brothers and our sister congregations no sheep stealing. And this, too, is a problem yet in our church body. Because somebody comes to our church who happens to live closer to our church than the one to which we belong, we now go and we extol all the virtues of our congregation, and wouldn't they like to consider joining our parish? This is not proper behavior. They know that your church is there. They came to your church. And if they are members of and active people, not only of Lutheran congregations, but Christian congregations where we know the gospel is, we don't seek to gain them as our own, and certainly not from fellow parishes of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Paul talked about that too in Romans, about not preaching the gospel where others had been, to avoid this very thing of sheep stealing. It still goes on, and it ought not to go on, brethren. It's not ethical behavior. We ought to refuse to serve former members of our congregation. What do you think that would happen to a doctor who went in and start patting on a tummy of some patient that belonged to another doctor? We're going to get all kinds of requests to have marriages, funerals, baptisms, all kinds of services for former members, and it's very painful for us to say goodbye to lovely people who love us and whom we have come to love through a long ministry, perhaps, but I plead with you in the name of Christ, you must do this. And I know that pain because I had to go through it when I left my parish and became a district president, but you must do it for the sake of ethical behavior and for the sake of your successor. And that's why I always advise retired people, too, to get out of the congregation that they've served. That advice is not by any means universally followed, but it ought to be, I hope, because It's not that the pastor's going to ask unethically, but the people continue to put pressure on him. They ask your advice, and they want you to do this. Oh, Pastor so-and-so, you baptized my baby, and, you know, now they'd like him to baptize their grandchild. And so on and on this thing goes, and pressure is put on them. You cannot perform those services and maintain those close ties with former members and be engaged in ethical behavior at the same time with your brother pastors and with your sister congregations. Nor dare you listen to complaints about your successor. Now, our own ego always likes to be built up by having somebody else put down. And what is more tragic, and it happens, that members of a congregation dissatisfied with their present pastor will come in mass and visit with the former pastor and now give him a big tale of woe about what a louse they have now and what a great guy he was. Now, those are often, incidentally, the same people who, when the next pastor comes, will tell him that they had a great pastor and now they don't. So don't believe a lot of this stuff in the first place, but secondly, don't let yourself become embroiled in the controversies of other congregations. We can do sometimes irreparable damage through that kind of thing. And for the day when you become counselor, it means that you dare not let dissidents come in to see you without the presence of the pastor. People get very angry when the district president or the circuit counselor says, I'm not going to sit down with you if you have come to the point where you can't solve this thing with your pastor. Then I'm willing to sit down with you and with the pastor, but I'm not willing to sit down with you and let you now simply run him down and he has no opportunity to respond. You destroy your relationship with that pastor. You do his ministry no good. You must act ethically in all of this. All of this is common sense, but it only comes out of experience to say that very frequently the very things that I'm warning against are things that still go on. Finally, to district officials as well. Be courteous and let your district counselor, circuit counselor, and your district president know when you're considering a call. And not simply that you have accepted it and you are moving next week, that you ask for a transfer of your professional membership. I think all of you know that we have not only an individual communicant membership in a congregation, but we have a professional membership. Seems so self-evident to mention that fact, but before you can be installed in a different district, you need to have a transfer from the former district president to the district president, who in turn must authorize your installation. Now, some strange things happen in our church. We find out that teachers sometimes are installed 4 months into a parish and nobody ever heard that they were there. The president has never heard. And it can happen to us as well, so make sure that your district president is informed. Don't solicit for calls through other district presidents than your own. If there comes a time in your ministry that you feel a change might be desirable, there's nothing wrong with coming in to talk to your district president about that and say, either because of this situation, that situation, or I just think it would be good for me and for my parish to consider the possibility of a change. That's not angling for a call. That's not sending out your vita to different congregations or whatever. But it is improper, in my judgment, that you, in the midst of the Missouri district, begin to send out mimeographed letters to presidents of other districts and ask them for calls. If you want to call, your district president knows how to handle sending out letters to other district presidents. He's sent a few before. So talk to him, and don't, without his knowledge, simply send out letters hither and yon, all mimeographed, and the only thing that's in bright print is Dear President So-and-so, so that you know that this thing's gone out to 12 other places. Share with your officials problem situations. And finally, you owe ethically also practice that conforms with that of the synod. I say that in this instance not simply for confessional reasons, because of our confessional commitment, because all kinds of mischief has been excused under the guise of a person's being faithful to his confessional commitment. But you owe practice that is consonant with the doctrine and practice of the Synod also for ethical reasons. And one of the nicest quotes on this, since we during this year had C.S. Lewis brought to us on a couple of occasions, maybe you're familiar with something called On Moving with the Times, appeared in Christianity Today quite a while ago. C.S. Lewis says, "At the outset, I must deal with an unpleasant business. It seems to the layman that in the Church of England, we often hear from our priests doctrine which is not Anglican Christianity. It may depart from Anglican Christianity in either of two ways. One, it may be so broad or liberal or modern that it in fact excludes any real supernaturalism and ceases to be Christian at all. Two, it may on the other hand be Roman. It is not, of course, for me to define to you what Anglican Christianity is. I am your pupil, not your teacher, but I insist that wherever you draw the lines, bounding lines must exist beyond which your doctrine will cease either to be Anglican or to be Christian, and I suggest that the lines come a great deal sooner than many modern priests think. I think it is your duty to fix the lines clearly in your own minds, and if you wish to go beyond them, you must change your profession." Now listen to the next paragraph. And he could have substituted Lutheran for what went before. "This is your duty, not specially as Christians or as priests, but as honest men. There is a danger of the clergy developing a special professional conscience which obscures a very plain moral issue. Men who have passed beyond these boundary lines are apt to protest that they have come by their unorthodox opinions honestly. And in defense of those opinions, they're prepared to forfeit professional advancement. Thus, they come to feel like martyrs. But this simply misses the point which so gravely scandalizes the layman. We never doubted that the unorthodox opinions were honestly held. What we complain of is your continuing your ministry after you have come to hold them. We always knew that a man who makes his living as a paid agent of the Conservative Party may honestly change his views and honestly become a communist. What we deny is that he can honestly continue to be a Conservative agent and to receive money from one party while he supports the policy of another." I think the point is extremely important because reference was made somewhere on campus about cooperate and graduate or whatever. In terms of our position, and that once we get out, we do as we jolly well please. It's not just a theological issue. It's a moral issue. It's a moral issue. And you want to go out there as honest men, as well as, by the grace of God, Orthodox Lutheran Christians. Well, all of this is more part of spiritual formation than it is of necessarily theological growth. Pray God that in all of our dealings, also for the sake of the gospel, the Lord might help us to be those kind of ethical Lutheran Christian teachers that will, by our ethical behavior, also maintain and build respect, not just for our ministry, but for the Christian ministry in general. May God bless you as you do. And may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all. Amen.